Good morning, diners and travelers of the world. You're listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig. I think we're calling it that today.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Ann. How are you this fine morning?
Fine. And, you know, a lot of people think that what we really enjoy the most about this wonderful job is traveling, seeing wonderful places, eating great food. But you know what? I think probably the best thing about it is actually talking to some of these really talented, inspirational chefs. And we have one that's certainly inspirational coming up, Gail Gand. And that's G-A-L-E, not G-A-I-L.
Yeah, that ends reminding me because I misspelled it. But Gail is a legend as a pastry chef, and recently produced yet another book on the subject of wonderful sweet things, which, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy the interview with her.
What all to say about Gail Gand, pastry chef extraordinaire, Food Network personality, co-owner and chef at True in Chicago, a cookbook author, many cookbooks. Hello, Gail.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
And the mother of twins, which we're just talking about.
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. She has 12-year-old and 4-year-old twins. Amazing. And working
it's a
restaurant.
Handful over here.
did you ever meet Kathleen Blake, who works for Melissa Kelly in Orlando?
No.
Well, she had twins as well.
She had, well, Kathleen.
She has four altogether.
She has four now. And she's a full working chef. And about the time that she went and had a pregnancy test after the twins, so she at that point had three, the doctor's office called and said the test was positive. And she said, "I'm sorry, you have the wrong number," and hung up.
Well, I remember when we got the call that we were having twins, I called my husband and told him. And the phone went dead. And then he came back on the line, and I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "I'm thinking state goal." That's his first response, which I thought was, you know, he went right to like, "Oh, my God, how are we going to pay for college?"
That's funny.
And that's how.
Anyhow, you were going to be talking to us about holiday desserts, and then you were going to be talking about, I think we came down to the fact that I really would like your thought on where our desserts are going in the future. And also, you have this program on butter and support of farmers with real butter, mm-hmm. and bringing it back. I mean, isn't that a very important element of how we're getting back to basic healthy food, such as real butter?
I find it is. You know, as people want to be better bakers, one of the things that sort of somehow fell by the wayside was using just sort of pure ingredients. And I've been working with America's Dairy Farmers just reteach people about the attributes of butter, you know, what great textural elements it adds to things, the flavor that can't be reproduced by anything else. That, you know, for me, it's a fundamental. One of my books is called Butter, Sugar, Flour, Eggs, so it's...
That's a great,
you know,
title.
It's one of my, like, main components that I use every day, and I wouldn't think of using anything else at all. And so, you know, there had been a time where people sort of wandered away from it, and I think there's simple things you can do like that to be a better baker, like just using great quality ingredients and real food, real ingredients, which I think in general we're going back to more real food and understanding that that's much better for you and it's better for our kids, it's more satisfying, so we don't tend to overeat as much if what we are eating has more...
Right.
Not only nutritional value, but just more flavor and more excitement going on, which brings you back to just real ingredients.
Well, how do you come down on lard?
I like using lard. I don't use it a lot because I don't live in the South, so it's not as accessible. And my mother was a great pie baker, though she was Jewish. So she didn't use a lot of lard as, you know, one of her ways to get a great texture.
That's true,
but
yeah.
She was a proponent of butter and then a little bit of shortening to kind of lighten things up. But I love lard as well. You know, I got to cook with Julia Child when she was in her 8 and asked her at that point, you know, what's your secret to longevity? And as she's slathering butter on her corn on the cob that we were having, she said, "Everything in moderation, darling." And I believe it. So, you know, things like lard, obviously you don't want to have huge amounts of it, but I think in the right place, it's appropriate.
No, I was just going to say that it's really rather a scandal that for decades the mass food producers got away with producing a revolting chemical substitute for butter, which it turns out is much worse for you than butter anyway.
Isn't that ironic? And I remember there was one time you know, because I have children, we have babysitters and au pairs, and we had an au pair living with us. I think she was from New Zealand, and she had bought a tub of that, I can't believe it's not butter.
All right.
Oh,
and I put a Post-it on it. It was in my refrigerator, and it said, I can't believe, and then my Post-it said, that this is in my refrigerator. So, I was like, how did this get in here?
Well, we used to, I grew up in wartime and post war, mm-hmm. that's Second World War, England,
mm-hmm.
When we had margarine because there was no choice.
Because there was no
butter
right.
being produced in quantity. So I remember when my mother would always say, if you're hungry, you can always have bread and margarine. And I ate a lot of that, of course.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was for a different reason. You didn't have a choice. We have
yes,
a choice
exactly.
now.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And there's no excuse at this point. You know, and there's such good ingredients out there. There's such great chocolate available, really good high-quality cocoa powder, not just to professional pastry chefs like myself, but, you know, they're in the grocery stores now.
Right. And sugar. What do you think about the revolution in sugar?
Well, you know, what I see mostly, two things. You know, soda pop, kind of boutique soda pop, straying away from corn syrup and less corn syrup in our world and more cane sugar. So in that arena, cane sugar's the hero. Then if you go into the baking arena, there's all these fabulous sugars, which I used to live in England. I lived there for 3 years, and so had all these, you know, muscovado and really flavorful, interesting, fruity-flavored sugars available, which are now available here in America, especially organic. Terrific. It just gives you so much variety.
And so you must have been a hero in the...
Were you working in pudding heaven?
It was funny, when I first got there, they called me the pudding chef, and I didn't realize that's the generic term for dessert, and I thought, well, I do more than just pudding, and found out that, you know, it's a great honor to be called the pudding chef.
You bet. You're the one who's part of the menu everybody's interested in.
Right.
Nothing else is
I made a lot of friends over there, I must say.
We were talking to Eric Repair the other day,
mm-hmm.
and Anne said, will you join me in a campaign to stamp out the use of the word entree for a main course. And he said, of course he would try that. And I said, it's probably like this. The reason it's called entree is because it comes before the part of dinner everybody's really interested in, which is pudding.
The important part of the meal, the dessert.
Except for me, I have no sweet tooth, Gail.
Oh, you'd be a good pastry chef. You know, one of the downfalls is if you do and you're with it all day, you know, it ends up in the wrong place.
Well, most of the pastry chefs I know are thin, actually. I think it's because they're around it all day. But.
Well, I think the ironic thing for me, about a year or two ago, I wrote a book called Chocolate and Vanilla.
I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, okay. You've got it there. And it was sort of hard to reveal to my readers and my guests and customers that I cook for that I'm not crazy about chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
I love knowing about it and I understand it intricately. But given a choice between chocolate and vanilla, I'm a vanilla girl, really.
Uh-huh.
I love the subtlety of it and just sort of how it works well with others. It's a flavor that you can feature on its own, but combined with other things makes everything else around it taste better and look better.
Yeah.
So I find
watch out for that. There's going to be a vanilla crisis. It sounds like, because I read a report in the newspaper the other day that the vanilla crop in Madagascar developed some kind of root rot kind of...
Oh my, like the wine industry.
I don't know whether it's quite the same, but mm-hmm. you sort of get the general idea.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know the vanilla queen?
I'll say that again. Do I know the vanilla queen? No. Who's that?
Patricia Rain. Yeah, check out her website, vanillaqueen.com.
Oh, cute. Well, you know, there are other sources besides Madagascar, and Mexico has really developed their vanilla exports. You know, it used to be sort of an unreliable crop, and that's changed over the last decade. So
I'm just worried about the poor old Malagasy people who rely on this, because this is about the only cash crop they have.
Price does fluctuate on vanilla quite a bit. It goes up and down throughout the year, so it may just be a price increase as well. You know, so they may make their numbers or make their money, but on less crop.
Gail, how do you characterize your baking style? I mean, you cook in an establishment, true, I'm talking about. I don't know if you're cooking at the other one or not.
Yeah.
And you're baking there. But at least in true, and the style is very not experimental, but very contemporary.
Well, but if you look at my work, really, the basis of it is very traditional, which is sort of funny because I'm not a traditional girl. But my inspiration is, you know, my grandma, my mother, my Aunt Jimmy, penny candy from when I was a kid. So stuff has a level of familiarity to it, and then I sort of give it a twist or make it a little modern or, you know, add an additional flavor that you might not always find. So there is this sort of comforting familiarity, whether it's my fine dining fancy pants stuff at True or it's at our restaurants in Wheeling, Illinois, in the Westin Hotel there where we have a steakhouse and we have an Italian osteria.
Yeah, the osteria, I have to admit that I have never been to True. I mean, I don't go to Chicago very often, but I really feel that I'm missing out.
I'm always happy when I hear people haven't been because that means there's still more customers to be had. We're almost 10 years old. We'll be 10 years in May, which is, restaurant is kind of like dog years, like every year counts.
I know.
Seven, so we're sort of more than middle-aged, so I like hearing that we haven't hit everybody yet, and there's still new customers.
Oh, I mean, it's been on my list for ages, and I don't know how I managed to miss it. I guess, like, when I'm on assignments, like, the last assignment I was on was really to cover the more experimental restaurants, because it's become such a hotbed of experimental restaurants.
Right.
Yeah, so we did, you know, Grant's Place. And
Yeah, there's always good food in Chicago, whether you want to go, you know, traditional or ethnic or temporary cutting edge. We've got it all, which is why it's such a great food town to be working from. And me, as a baker, you know, Midwest is sort of the heartland, is where a lot of good, serious bake is always going on. Whenever I go on book tour, I'm always in, like, Ohio and Indiana and just sort of right across the Midwest, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois. Maybe because it's dairy country, but that's where a lot of the serious bakers live.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with that. I lived in, went to school in Ann Arbor, lived in Indianapolis, you know, that whole thing.
A lot of important pie bakers here. Though I get to judge the national pie championship
past
year, which is held down in Florida, but people drive from all over the country to go down there, and I, you know, it's hundreds of people bringing their pies, schlepping their pies across country. It's really
they bring their own pies, and they don't bake them there. They bring
them. Well, they do both. They bring some. Some are in, like, RVs, baking as they go.
Oh, geez.
They have an oven in their RV. Very funny. And then there's some ovens down there for people to bake during the competition.
Well, now, trends. I said that I would like your thoughts on where we're going next with desserts. I mean, everyone says the mini dessert. Like, I see this is true in Europe a lot where you get different, and actually it's true in a lot of places here too, you get an assortment of small bites of dessert. Is that one of the directions you would list? For
well, as much as you say that, you know, I had a book come out in, it was either 1999 or 2000 called Gail Gann's Just a Bite. And
yeah.
It was all one and two bites
right.
dessert that came from our restaurant, True. Because we do these elaborate 10 and 12 course menus, all that was really, the only room you had left was for Just a Bite at the end of the meal.
I remember
so
that
book. Got small that year. And so for 10 years I've been talking about and making miniature desserts. I actually have to do some today for a bridal shower of my best friend. Her daughter's getting married, and I'm doing some little mini chocolate pot de crèmes for it. I'm going to do some little eggnog, cream cheese, stuffed cookies, and some little mini cranberry angel food cake. So
nice
I just think mini is so versatile because you can pair it then.
Yes.
It seems to me that that's what the complex mini dessert is, what we get when Anne tells a restaurateur who's feeding us that she doesn't eat dessert. they bring it anyway.
They bring something small.
They bring it anyway, and it's supposed to be something small.
But one of the trends I do see, I just, you know, I was working this winter with America's Dairy Farmers developing cookie recipes using real butter to help people get back to butter. And some of the recipes that we developed, sort of like my work, were traditional recipes, but with, like, newfangled ingredients. So it might be a traditional buttery recipe, but there's some lemongrass or some kind of exotic ingredient, bring in some new flavors. So I see that a lot right now is either using some sort of exotic ingredient or using a more sophisticated chocolate in your chocolate chip cookie.
The possibilities of that just blossomed. I mean, I've never seen so many different chocolates.
We have a website even where you can go for these interesting cookie recipes. It's just called butterisbest.com. And you can see what I mean where, you know, we've taken some classic and just, you know, given it a little twist. One of the ones we did was a molten lava, you know, the molten lava cake, right?
Yes.
Well, there's a molten lava cookie recipe there.
Huh.
So it's sort of like a one or two bite version of that liquid in the center cake, but it's in a cookie form.
Uh-huh.
The other thing I do see, I'm not sure if I love it, but I do see herbs and savory flavors coming into dessert.
Yeah, it's what I like.
So kind of a blurring of, you know, what herbs and spices are in the dessert kitchen and what ones are in the savory kitchen, that's starting to sort of lose its divinity.
And then they move into the bar.
Yes, they've moved into the bar as well. And cheese, too, kind of. You know, cheese is moving in and out of savory and dessert. I just had some blue cheese shortbread over the weekend with rosemary.
Oh, that sounds good.
And, you know, it's sort of, it was great with soup and it's great with fruit.
Now that's
great, yeah. Compote, so it can go either way.
That, I like that trend. I think I'm going to enjoy that.
Me too. I'm just crazy for cheese, so.
Yeah, me too.
I like that.
Well, what else here, Robert? You wanted to make sure, Gail, when we hang up, can you hang on a little bit so we can get your email?
Oh, sure.
Great, that's
good. Sure. You know, I have a busy life. I have a bunch of restaurants. I have a root beer company.
Oh, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
But I do this. I've been making root beer ever since I came back from England. So that was the one thing I really missed.
I wondered. I never heard that you were doing that until just, like, recently.
Oh, I've been doing it, let's see, I think I started in 95, so almost 15 years now. And it's nice. It keeps winning taste tests, like the New York Times rated it number one, and there was an NPR tasting that rated it really high, I think number one. And for me, it's just a hobby, though. It was to always be able to have some free root beer in my wine cellar because I didn't want to run out. But I would serve it in my restaurants, and it got popular, and people wanted to take it home, so we started bottling, and then a local distributor called and said, you know, we're getting requests for your root beer. Do you make root beer? Can we get it? So now it's sold nationally, and when I do a bat, I usually do the cinnamon ginger vanilla flavored. So I use Nielsen Massey Vanilla, who's a local vanilla producer here in Chicago. They do a cold press process. It's very high quality.
I know the name, but I didn't know they did it in Chicago.
Yeah, they're in Waukegan, which is a suburb of Chicago, and they also have a plant in the Netherlands, is where their other production plant is. But I do 500 cases at a time now.
Wow.
So it's,
well, it's a really hot trend, root beer.
Apparently. You know, again, my grandfather used to make it. And it was sort of a family love. And I just did it for selfish reasons. That's what's so funny to me. But apparently there's other people out there that desperately need root beer as well.
Well, did you ever feel you're lucky? I think you're lucky.
I'm extremely lucky. There is no other explanation for my life than just sheer luck. You know, I had a TV show on the Food Network called Sweet Dreams for 8 years. It just went off the air in 08, but I
didn't realize it was off the air.
Yeah, I was doing that for 8 years, which is longer than some marriages, I joke, you know. A lot of people didn't last that long on the Food Network even. I have, you know, 6 cookbooks to my name. I have a 7th one coming out in April of 09. It's on Brunt.
Oh, that's very hot in Paris now.
Oh, is it? Oh, look at me. I'm just right on the...
Yeah, you have all your antennas in the right direction. Yeah.
Well, no, what happened was with these twins, when I had my twins, I couldn't do dinner parties anymore. But what I could do was I could have people over for brunch because it was a meal that you could include the whole family. You know, kids eat that food. It only lasts 2 hours versus a dinner party of, you know, 4 or 5 hours. Nobody gets drunk. You know, people, they leave. They come and they leave. So it was the food that I miss as a chef. I would always miss breakfast because I'd be working.
Dear.
And so I love brunch any time of day. So I wrote a whole book on it.
Yeah, well, we did. Make sure we are on the list to get a copy of that.
Okay.
It was, as I said, it was a hot trend in Paris. We did one ourselves, our friend's apartment, while we were there.
And we did an Obama victory brunch video when we were there.
And
anyway,
you know,
it sounds like somebody's trying to get us online, and we should let you get back to the twins and the restaurants.
Okay.
So say goodbye to the audience, but hang on the line if you would.
Thanks for having me on. Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Please do email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Or you can just go on our website and click. I guess you're already on the website. You can just click to email us. You can also click to refer a friend, which is good. I like getting those little messages.
And if you're really interested in blogging, then you can go to onthemenuradio.blogspot.com and join us there and express your opinion about what you would like to talk about and also what it is that we're talking about. So two ways to get in touch with us. We hope that you will. And it makes our day.
Yes. Now we have another astonishingly talented woman chef coming up next. Somebody that we've known for quite a long time and have watched her business grow. Why don't we just let Amy Sherber tell us all about it?
We're talking to an old friend, meaning that I've known her for a number of years.
Even though she's only 17.
Yes. Amy Sherber of Amy's Bread, a very famous bread company, and a new book which is called and displays and highlights the sweeter side of Amy's Bread, and this includes cakes, cookies, bars, pastries, and more from, it says, New York City's favorite bakery, and I bet it is. I think it is. Now, where were we when we visited, or were we at Hell's Kitchen?
We were in our Hell's Kitchen location, yes, when we first met, talked before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was my original space, which I opened 16 years ago, so it's been quite a long time now, but it's been a great adventure, and it's fun to share our recipes with people now and get them out there in the public.
Yeah, well, see, that was my next question is, I mean, you have so much work to do, and you have a small child, you have all these locations, you supply bread to the top restaurants in New York City. Why a cookbook?
You know, in fact, so many people were writing us requests on our website and also just calling and stopping in and asking, you know, don't you have the recipe for this kind of cake? Wouldn't you be able to share how to make this muffin with us? And after enough of that, it sort of just became obvious that we should work on a cookbook. And then we also have a customer that comes to our Hell's Kitchen location regularly, and she ended up being a cookbook agent, but also just a big fan. And she said, you know, there are just so many great things you make, and there's such a wonderful story here. I think you should write it down. And she encouraged us just by being kind of a friend and a fan in the neighborhood. And so she got us to write a proposal, and then once we got it written, you know, she showed it to some different publishers. And once we had signed the contract, then we realized we were in for a huge lot of work.
Oh, it's terrible.
It sounded really fun up until the point we had to start to work on it. But in fact, having it finished is a really wonderful thing as well. It's very gratifying to see the response, and also just to see the book in print with the pictures of our food and the stories about the bakery that we feel so strongly about.
Oh, and aren't those pictures just fabulous?
Yeah, they're just mouth-watering.
They are.
And really want to bake everything, or at least just read the book, because there are little stories to go with each product in each picture, too, so it makes it fun to just look through.
Right, and you can see a picture of your son in here, too.
Yes, which was great. Our editor allowed me to have him in the pictures and to really show how much fun it is to bake with children, which is, you know, a total adventure. Sometimes good and sometimes a huge mess, you know, but it's sweet, though, and it's nice to be able to have that in the book. I'm really happy that that was part of it.
Now, this is also a terrific resource for those people who are out of reach of Amy's Bakery, right? Because you have a remarkable, was it, you said 16 bakery stores now?
No. We have three stores.
Three stores.
16. And then two kitchens.
So the 16 was the years you've been in business.
Yes, okay. We 16 business, but we have just three stores, which certainly is keeping me busy enough already. But it's true that, you know, we're here in New York City, and a lot of people come here on vacation or just on a little, they're passing through town and they drive by and stop in one of our stores, and many, many people have said that they come, whenever they're in New York, they stop by to get some treats. But now, you know, this book is out there across the country, and people all over the place are writing back to us, again, on our website, saying how much they enjoy it, from Kentucky, you know, Chicago, California, all over the place, because it is a universal selection of things that people do enjoy, even if you don't live in New York. But now it lets you remember to come here when you're come and visit us when you're in New York also.
Well, they're everybody's favorite recipes, but you usually give an unusual twist you make each one of these your own.
Right, we've tried to make them something unique, and we also really feel strongly that we give clear instructions on how to make things, because, you know, I think the benefit of being bakers and being in a bakery is that we really make these products every day, and we really know all the tricks, and we share them. It's not like we just think of them and make them up in our kitchen and then we write them down and that's it. You know, they're really tried and true day in, day out, so they're great recipes.
Yeah, and you'd have that, and each one has this tips and techniques section.
Right. And one of the things, when I say we, I'm talking about my co-author, Toy Dupre, and I, and she's worked with me since we first opened back in 1992. She's the executive pastry chef now, but also she's a great bread baker as well. But she and I both worked on this together, and we both feel so strongly that people should have a scale. So that's one of the things that we've promoted from the very first pages of the book, is that you should purchase a simple scale, because then you can really make your recipes work no matter what. If you're in a moist climate or a dry climate, or buy flour in one grocery store, and, you know, everything varies from depending on where you are.
What about eggs? Somebody wrote a bakery cookbook we interviewed, she explained the difference, even if you get the same size egg. I mean, like, it's great at the difference.
And when you make a cake, you really want to make sure your weight of your eggs is right. So we really think, measuring by weight is foolproof, and we were able to give grams, ounces, and then cups and volume measures. Our editor was very involved with our decision to do that, and he felt strongly also that we could use gram weight as well, and we're very pleased to do that because that's how we measure in the bakery, and it's very accurate.
Right.
We think that people will love baking when they try it, and you know, I've given scales as a gift to a lot of my friends now, and they look really nervously when they open the package. What if I have to use this now? And it's like, a scale is really easy to use. You know, it's simple. Just zero it out, put your bowl on there, zero it again, and start to put your ingredients in, and you'll start to love to bake with a scale.
Oh, yeah. I don't bake, but I wouldn't even attempt to bake without a scale.
Yeah, exactly. No,
well, really. the great thing also is you put grams in there as well, because Anne's had the problem of working with people with recipes for articles that she's publishing, and some of them are in volume measures, which are notoriously unreliable.
Right.
And then if you get a recipe from Europe or from Australia, the weights are all in grams.
Exactly.
And a cookbook with pounds and ounces isn't going to be very much use to them. So
absolutely true. I have a lot of friends that live abroad, and they really love being able to use this because they use grams when they bake, for sure. So,
of all these recipes, this is not a trick question. You can think about it in a minute. Is which story and which recipe would you highlight? We can do a couple of them if you'd like.
Sure. Well, I mean, one thing that I really recommend, one recipe is the chocolate hazelnut biscotti, because they're delicious and they're quite easy. I mean, they take a little time because you bake them twice, but whenever I serve them, people just love them. And there's something that you can make and then, you know, put a bag in the freezer or put it in a closed container and use them, serve them for several days. So you're enjoying the benefits of all your work for over time, which I think is a nice thing after you go through the effort of baking. And they're one of our recipes that we've had from the very beginning. So they're really special. I think the almond brioche toast is kind of a nice recipe.
Oh, I looked at that. That looked great.
Yeah, it's delicious, and it's not that hard. As long as you can either bake your own pan loaf of brioche or purchase a loaf, and so that saves you some time. And the whipping up of the topping isn't really so hard, but then when you bake this, it's delicious, and people just love it. It's really, very unctuous, very beautiful, you're going to a nice pastry shop. And you can actually make the topping and just bake off two of them. Let's say that you just have two people, and you're making a small batch, and then the next day you can do it again, so they're nice and fresh. You know, you don't have to use up the topping all at once. It stores well in the refrigerator. So it's a great recipe and fun, not too hard.
Tell me about your mom's whole lemon pie. That's unique.
Oh, that's a great one, yeah. You know, the key is to have a sharp blender. It is so easy, and it's so delicious. And the lemons that we started to use in the first place were the ones from her neighbor's yard in Arizona, and so they're delicious lemons that don't have the taste of being in a refrigerator for a week.
Oh, wow.
You know, not too waxy or anything. So when you pop one of those in the blender, you just get this fresh, pure skin and the nice inside. And sometimes we've had better luck using Meyer lemons because there's more juice and the rind isn't so thick. But whatever you find, as long as you have a nice sharp blender and the lemon looks pretty juicy and you trim away excess pith if there is a lot of the thick peel, just throw it in there with the butter, egg, you know, it's so easy, and the sugar, and then you just put it in your pan and bake it. And we found that the first day it's very mild. The second day the lemon zest comes out. It's more flavorful. I love it the second day. By the third and fourth day it gets really tangy. And those who love it tangy even, you know, get more flavor out of it. So it's kind of a fun thing too, because it changes from one day to another with the way that the zest gets stronger when it's sitting there.
Well, Amy, I'm sure that our listeners would really love this. It's on our website already. That you may want to pass along your website address for people who want to know about what you're doing.
Right. Well, it's www.amysbread.com, and there's no apostrophe. It's just AMYSBREAD.com, and you can find out a little bit more about the bakery, how to find our store, and see some pictures of our products, and catch up with what we're up to.
Yeah, maybe we can catch up. I guess we're going to be in New York.
We will be in New York. Whether we'll be in the neighborhood, I don't know.
Yeah, if we are, we will look you up.
Check
it out.
I've moved from one location to another, so you have to let me know where you're going to be.
Okay.
And I can cross paths with you.
I don't know how you do it, to tell you the truth. I remember when you started out, you just jumped into it.
I did. I didn't know what I was getting into, and I just wanted to open a neighborhood bakery, and it's become that and more.
It's an institution.
I never really knew if it would be more retail or wholesale or what, and it's been fun to see how it's turned out, and, you know, to see that people really do want sweet things, too, which is kind of the point of this book. I started as a bread baker, wanting
right.
to have a bread shop, and now the bread is certainly an important part of what we do, but it's not our main product by any means. You know, we have so many other sweets, and then we have the sandwiches and all these things.
We even have sticky buns.
We have sticky buns that people love. Yes, they are really good. And
but I love your bread, Amy.
Yeah, well, the bread is really, for us, still a very important part of what we do because it's the heart of, you know, my passion as a bread baker. And I think making really good bread lets people know what you're made of. It's pretty complicated, so I think it's a good expose of what our skills are.
Well, anyhow,
good
luck with this
congratulations.
Book. Congratulations on your success in business, and give your son a little quick pinch for me. He's so adorable.
Oh, I will. He's a sweetheart, so I will. He's so funny. I'll give him a little hug for everybody. So I get to get an extra one today, right?
Yep.
All right, good.
Thanks,
well, thank
Amy.
You very much for having me, and best luck.
It was great talking to you again. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
And we can now take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. We're switching from our two sweet spots to some beverages, which Peter said you could put them together.
Yeah, something pretty sweet anyway, but in the one case with no added sugar, in the one case with added sugar, because first up we're going to talk to a wonderful Italian winemaker whose sparkling wine we enjoyed at New Year's.
And that's the one with sugar?
Yes, and it's called Rotari, and the product of a wine cooperative called Mezza Corona. In northern Italy, and then following right on behind that, Io Juice, which is a wonderful Sicilian blood orange juice produced produced under the auspices of a new friend from New Jersey who's been in the food business but got into the organic Sicilian blood orange juice almost by accident, as he goes on to explain, but as Anne was hinting at, put these two together and you have an absolutely killer mimosa. So here's sparkling wine followed by blood orange juice.
Ciao, Lucio Matricardi. How are you?
Very well. Buonasera a tutti.
Buonasera. Buongiorno. Here, you're calling from Italy. From what
buongiorno,
city in Italy?
Right. Yeah, here it's 6 o'clock, so it's dark.
Yes. And what, you're in Trentino?
I am in Trentino, actually. I am in Trentino. I am the winemaker of Mezza Corona Group.
And you were going to talk to us about a particular wine, a Rotari, but you're also going to then talk to us about Mezza Corona. What can you tell us about Rotari?
Rotari is an historical name in Italy, and it's one of the most important sparkling wine made in Italy. And history or legend, anyway, the name of Rotari derived from Longobard King Rotari.
Really?
Yes, who fought one of the most important battles in the valley of Adige, where we are. And so from this important king, we took the name for a really important product.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a delightful, delightful sparkling wine.
Yes.
And the sample we had was a Reserva.
Yes, you have one of the most important products of the Rotari family. And actually that is a product that will enjoy people above all to have a fantastic evening in San Valentine Day. And so for that reason we want to offer this unique product to the palates of the couples that will be enjoyed San Valentine Day.
Valentine's Day, that's for sure. We killed one on, when was it?
On New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve
is also a good time.
Yeah, we can save this one to have with the oysters. On, won't that be good with oysters for Valentine's Day?
Yeah, it will.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely have to do that.
What characteristic is the does this wine get from the region you're in?
First of all, the Rotari is a winery located in a beautiful valley that is the Adige Valley. For people that don't know where it is, it's simple to identify the area because we are just north of Verona and close to the border of Austria. And the weather, the climate, it's really unique. Just to think, we have 400 lakes and some many glaciers and mountains that arrive to 9,000 feet. So there is a really unique environment.
And you said there's deep snow on the ground right now, but the grapevines don't mind. I guess they're sleeping, right? They're sleeping, getting ready for the spring?
Now they're sleeping because they had done a great job during the harvest, actually. We harvest here around September and October, and we had an incredible harvest this year, and the vineyards really gave birth to incredible rich and fresh grapes, so they need now to sleep. We leave them to sleep, to have rest.
Now, the wine we sampled was a 2003 vintage, so you're making and keeping for about 4 years, I think it says on the material that we got.
Yeah, it's every winemaker knows that the first thing to make a good wine and a unique wine, you need a lot of passions, of course, and passion at the same time, and a lot of so time to leave the wine to rest. In fact, the Rotari, and the one that you have there, is the Reserva 2003, stay in on lease for more than 4 years. Because maybe people don't know that Italy is also famous for the sparkling made in the same way of the champagne.
Yes, the champagne.
And exactly in the same wine process, where the bubbles are produced inside the bottles. So that is a really important characteristic to remember in order to appreciate the sparkling wine coming from Italy.
Now, a lot of people associate sparkling wine in Italy with Prosecco or with Asti from the Piemonte. What makes Rotari similar and different?
I don't know very well about that. And there is a name that identifies also by law the fact that Rotari is exactly a champagne just coming from Italy, so with appeal, the elegance and the style of Italy.
It is elegant.
The elegance, of course, and the name is a Talento. Talento is an important name that identifies the sparkling made in champagne method. That is totally different compared to other sparkling wine like Prosecco, where the technique is totally different, and also the style is totally different. So there is a totally difference between these two products.
So when people see Talento, then they will know that it's the Italian version of Method Champenoise.
Yes, exactly.
Talento Metodo.
Talento is a seal that guarantees by law the fact that, first of all, you can use only Chardonnay or Pinot Noir or Pinot Bianco. So you can blend only these three varieties, and you have to use the Champenoise method, so the second fermentation must to happen in the bottles, and then the maturation in bottles has to be minimum 15 months. So
no wonder it's so good. It's really good.
Are you appreciating that?
We certainly are. Yeah. I'm inclined to open this one right after we finish our conversation. the winery, though, Mezzacorona, makes a range of wines, and you're the winemaker responsible for those other wines too. So tell us quickly about some of those.
Yeah, Mezzacorona is an aggregation of producers. We have more than 1,500 small producers. And just think that every producer has less than 1.5 acres, so very small quantity of land, and they really take care like their son. And so we are able to process the grapes of all these producers that are located from the Garda Lake to the border almost of Austria, so vineyards that are located along the Adige River. And so we are able to produce both whites and reds, international or local varieties. Local varieties very famous for sure is Pinot Grigio, and we are the main producer of the world of Pinot Grigio, because Pinot Grigio likes this glacial and mountainous climate, and here really the Pinot Grigio found that a fantastic climate. And then also important reds like Terol de Gomarzemino, Lagrange, that are local varieties that now people really are enjoying.
And Cabernet Sauvignon.
Also Cabernet Sauvignon and the Merlot, but you know, the Italian people like to are more proud of their own product, and so for that reason I like sometimes more to speak about this incredible variety that give really unique emotions, and that I really hope people very soon have the opportunity to try and to enjoy.
Well, now, listeners, if you think that Lucio knows what he's talking about, let me tell you that this man has degrees beyond degrees. he's a master winemaker. He studied at the University of Bologna. He enrolled in viticulture and enology at the University of Bologna, which is, I believe, is the oldest university in the world. And also, you worked in cooperation with the University of California at Davis. I mean, you have...
Yes, I spent more than 2 years in Davis, in UC Davis, for my PhD program.
Wow.
It has been an incredible, incredible experience.
So you are a dottore. So you're a dottore,
yes,
Lucio.
I am.
a real dottore, Lucio. And now the good news, listeners, for you... Throughout the United States, but certainly in the northeastern United States and around the world in other countries, perhaps, Lucio, you can tell us, but the name Mezza, Mezza, Corona, Corona, will allow you to know that you're getting wines from this particular select part of the world, and the website is www.mezzacorona.it.
Yes.
I think. And you said that you're going to be in New York very soon, so maybe we'll even connect up with you there. But in the meantime, thank you so much for calling us all the way from the snowy Alpine region of Italy. You're calling us in the snowy region of western Pennsylvania, where we have snow on the ground, and it was snowing at a football game on Sunday last. But a pleasure to meet you this way, and we look forward to meeting you in person.
Yeah, we'd like to see you.
Pleasure has been mine, and I really hope people will enjoy the San Valentin Day with Clare Riserva, and I invite everybody to come to visit us. That for sure they will enjoy a glass of wine with me.
Oh, sounds good. We'll be there, Lucio. Ciao and grazie.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Ciao.
Al Nasty, why blood orange juice?
Why blood orange juice?
Yes.
In our travels to Sicily, we realized that there was a tremendous demand inside of the small towns where they were harvesting the oranges right off the land and utilizing on their, you know, on their plates.
And it's very healthy.
Oh, it's amazingly healthy. We did some research through the agricultural region to find out that the Sicilian blood oranges, which were very unique on their own, carry somewhere in the neighborhood of an average of 40% more vitamin C than regular oranges do.
And they're so much prettier.
Oh, they certainly are. There are three different types of blood oranges, one being the Moro, which is more or less the common one, but a little bitter, the Tarocco, which is a lighter color, but more of the sweeter version, and then the Sanguinello, which means blood in itself, that has, it's grown at the end of the season.
And that's what this is?
This is all three different varieties of those oranges.
Now, what's the reason for the quality of the product? Is it to do with the climate, the weather? Is it to do with the soil? Is it a combination of the two?
It's a combination of the two. The oranges come from a region around Mount Etna, and the soil there is a volcanic soil where throughout the year, whether it's the dead of winter or the dead of summer, there's a moistness in the ground where it kind of never gets dry. It's almost a it's almost like a wet soil, and this soil and these trees have been around since the trees on our land alone we can track back from the early 1800s.
Now, you're in New Jersey. You were not, I think, I don't know whether you were born in Sicily or not, but you certainly don't live there now. So tell us the interesting story of how you came to own this land in the first place.
Well, the land is actually my partner Salvatore's family land, and it's been in his family for generations. It happens to be quite a few parcels combined, and it was left toward the next generation of him and some of his cousins. And we came about this land because his cousins wanted to sell the land to developers, and my partner Sal wanted to maintain the land and give it down to his next generation as well, his children and his children's children. And we wound up going to Italy to try and come to a resolution, and we found out that a lot of the locals ate off this land. They picked oranges, olives, almonds, whatever they needed, as they wanted. So they came to the land, they realized that we were taking away, actually, food from people's mouths.
Oh.
Even though it was your land, so they were helping themselves to product off your land?
Oh, yeah, that's kind of common out there. I mean, the expression, we eat off the fat of the land? That's, they literally do. I mean,
they were eating off the fat of your land instead of
that. It's common. I mean, you know, there's so much of it. Whether we were to harvest it or not, it would grow wild. One of the benefits of harvesting is you'll get a full production of fruit and, other byproducts. Right now, we're only harvesting the blood oranges, but all of the other products, the people that are taking care of the land, they take it back and sell it into local markets or ship it into the northern part of Italy.
Now, what gave you the idea of getting into this as a business? This is not what you do every day, I don't think.
No. I'm actually in the food business.
Oh, okay.
My company imports food from all over the world, and we sell it to supermarket chains. And
what's it called, your company?
My other company is called Mutual Interest Transactions. And
Mutual Interest Transactions, I
say. Short for MIT, for short.
And oh, okay. Now, while we're at it, we ought to mention the correct title, the name of your product.
Right. Our name is IO, which stands for Italian Organics. We wanted to keep it simple, making it almost like an acronym, IO, when people ask for it, as opposed to something they may forget the name of now.
Okay.
IO sometimes gets confused with 10, but...
yeah, that's what I thought, too. And you decided to pick this one product, and you probably will expand to some of the other products in the future, I imagine, right?
Oh, yes, we
so
plan on...
So what do you do? You harvest the oranges, and then where do you process it and so forth?
After we harvest the oranges, we bring them down to a processing facility where they put it, it's almost like a squeezing factory, and we only press our oranges one time. You can take the same oranges and continue to press them two, three, some even press them four times, but we only press them once, and we then take the skins, and we give the skins to a laboratory that uses the oil from the skins. There's a lot of really good byproducts. There's I think it's called phenolic oils that come from the orange skins.
It's the best air freshener you can get.
Okay. Well, we give those to the people that harvest the land, and they kind of sell all the byproducts back to some of the other factories.
Well, let's get back to the fundamentals here. This stuff is absolutely delicious. Not only is it good for you.
Yeah, I'm getting tired of you drinking it all.
It looks like it's good for you because it's so dark in color and thick in texture.
It all.
Well, of course. why would I buy store-bought Florida orange juice when I can drink this product that's better for me anyway?
Yeah. You, quite honestly, you shouldn't. You shouldn't. If you would have, compare what we have in ours being, I mean, you know, just again, you know, the pigment of our skin, the, you know, has a strong portion of anthocyanins, and anthocyanins have always been recognized of, as an antioxidant. They're risk, has risk-reducing agents. I mean, there are flavones, hydroxyaminic acids. I mean, like I said, the higher content of vitamin C, you wouldn't think so, just that we don't have the consumer awareness that lets that identifies the difference between true Sicilian blood oranges and your domestic navel oranges.
Right. Well, let's do this. We've got our listeners. I'm sure their interest is peaked right now. So the last part of the equation is how do people get a hold of some, you know, can they order it online? Is there a store locator where they can find out where it's available in their neighborhood?
Right. Well, on our website, if you don't mind me, I'll mention the website.
No, please do. Absolutely.
It's www.iojuice.com.
Right.
And on there is a section where it says where to buy. And as well as that, we are setting up, or in the midst of setting up, an online store where we would ship anywhere in the United States. And I believe it's in either 6 or 12 unit packages. And we will make sure that it's affordable enough to buy that many. We've had great demand for it. That's really been one of our setbacks of not having an online store earlier, but we're going to tackle that within the next week or so. So keep your eyes open for that online store. In the meantime, it's available in the New York City area, the five boroughs around New York City, and the Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh area, and well, we're looking for distributors. So if any distributors are listening, we have a great opportunity to really get a fantastic product out there and really benefit the consumers out there. I mean, consumers would benefit tremendously. I mean, health-wise, you know, it's a great tasting product as you guys...
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, and it's the purest version. When we first came to introduce this product, we brought it to the factory and they said, why are you making it like, why not add sugar? Why not make it more, quote unquote?
Oh, no.
No, they wanted us to make it towards the masses.
Right.
And the masses, yes, sells into mainstream and probably more accepted. But, you know, because when you're in Italy, if you're in the more chic towns, Rome, Milan, you'll get blood orange juice, but you'll get an adulterated version with a lot of fructose and artificial sugars and sweeteners, and there's nothing artificial about ours. It's the purest version.
Well, this is a great story. It's a fascinating connection between the old world and the new, and between, you know, and comparing, if you like, newfangled adulterated products to the real stuff. So, Al, we're so glad you joined us on the program. Thank you so much for bringing us the story.
We are very much appreciative, and again, thanks for your assistance.
Yes, and maybe we'll stop by your land when we're in Sicily. In this
oh, brand. Please do.
Okay.
Thanks so much, guys.
Al, thank you so much.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. And I think we can digest all of that.
We can actually imbibe it rather than digest it, but we hope you join us on the other side because we have another segment coming up.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we have another segment lined up for you. It's amazing how many wonderful, wonderful people are out there in foodie land. This latest discovery, a fourth-generation farmer. Well, I'm going to have to order more of this yogurt because I've also decided to use these wonderful little jars, clear glass jars with the white lids for my spice jars, and I'm running short.
but that's not really the reason we thought white cow dairy was important, because as you'll hear in the interview, first of all, it's a wonderful product, but it's also a little bit about the survival of the small American family farm.
Well, here we've encountered yet another product that I totally adore. We're talking to Patrick Lango, or is it Longo?
It's Lango.
Lango. And he's from White Cow Dairy, fourth generation dairy farmer, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he sent us samples of his product
that I am just nuts for, yogurt and an energy drink. It's White Cow Dairy on Blue Hill Farm, and I just love the stuff, Patrick.
Well, you know, it's a long time in the making, and it's really, for a farm like ours, it's, I hate to say it, but it's a do-or-die thing. You know, my grandfather started our farm exactly 100 years ago. Well, actually, now it's 101. It was 1908. And so we kept it going, and you know, we know what we're doing, and people have tried, we've tried to get out of it at various times. We always got dragged back in, and in the latest generation, it's really a matter of how do you continue to farm the way you always did. We're essentially a 19th century farm.
Yeah.
And you
it's
know,
probably very much like the farm that I used to spend my summers on in Guernsey County, right?
Oh, you know, I had to say, it is. There, you know, there are these idyllic small family farms out there that are treasures, that are, you know, they're threatened only because they're not high volume and they're not factory farms, and they're doing things. They're really threatened just, I mean, you can't control the price of milk, and if you're beholden to it, and you're just trying to sell, you know, milk volume, and you won't make it unless you get big. And, you know, we know that, a lot of people, that's just the reality. So we just decided to do our own thing, which is go back to the 19th century creamery model when every village had their own place where, I mean, that was local foods. All the farmers took their cans and went down to the creamery, and everybody worked there, and they made the food there, and that was that. Some of it traveled, and some of it didn't, and everybody got fed. So,
yeah.
You know, when you looked at that, you go, oh, you know, small farms used to make money. Or they used to sustain themselves, and they were good places to live.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do you do that?
Yeah, of course, my uncle, my great uncle Frank, didn't have a life. I mean, he spent his whole life taking care of the cows.
It's nuts.
And the bottles, and we had bottles. We had the bottle sterilizer.
Yeah, but what Patrick's talking about now is that some people got really big, so the traditional fresh milk delivery model that mm-hmm. your Uncle Frank and lots of small farmers, you know, that was their livelihood. Now it's not. So now you have to make derivative products, right, Patrick? Is
well,
that
not
what
only
saying?
That, but I mean, the creamery made everything. So I mean, they were culturing products and making butters and buttermilks and the cheeses and soft cheeses. So I mean, in the creamery model, which is basically the dairy kitchen, you know, you made everything. If you think about milk, milk, there's more foods and more kind of foods and things that you can eat that are made with milk, basically, than any other substance on earth. I mean, it's just like, okay, there are. I mean, there's thousands. And so, and in the antique creamery, you know, they were making all these different things depending on the region and so on. And so, you know, I looked at that and I said, you know, what's wrong with that? Why not build a micro creamery, like a small thing where you could do it, and not have to be beholden to the industrial, you know, milk, high volume milk farms. And just create your own price, create your own food. So I stared at recipes in the 19th century. I said, wow, these are really good things, you know. I got to figure out a way to make them.
But why did you go to Italy to develop this?
My wife is from Italy. And so, you know, once every 2 years or so, we go back to visit her folks, her family. Her whole family's there.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, you're on these trips, and, you know, you're looking around, and it's obviously, that's the old world. And you can see, you know, I just would make these, she and I and my son would rent a car and just go visit farms and, you know, start just poking around and see what they were doing. And you want to learn the old ways and you want to reinvent new ways to make the old foods. And so that was my goal. And so I just started making all kinds of dairy foods. Anything you could think of.
What else? You sent energy drinks? And you said,
oh, yeah, we make yogurt.
Our
yogurt drink is essentially a sports drink, and it comes in a million flavors. You know, it's like we do black cherry, blueberry, lime. You know, it can be anything. And we do a whole line of yogurts. But then we do puddings, and we do custards.
Oh, I didn't know you did all that, too.
Right. And then I do sauces, yogurt sauces. I don't know if I sent you any of those.
No. What are they?
I do a habanero sauce.
No, you did. I haven't tried it yet. I forgot about that.
It's really versatile because you start using it and you're like, people go nuts over that because you can do anything with it. So they're like, oh,
I love to do that.
I put it together for potato pancakes because I love potato pancakes. And I'm like, oh, I want to do something. And so then I started out with that and I started putting in a jacket potatoes and playing with it like that. And then I just started, All of this stuff, it's just a flavor fest.
You're the only American I know that says jack and potatoes.
But I'm old, that's all. But what happens is, then started going on grilled meats and fish and into salads. And, you know, then I was like, oh, this is great. This is like a wonder drug. You know, you can put it anywhere.
Well, yeah.
And it becomes a base for marinades because it's this.
How many cows do you have?
Right now we milk just under 30 cows. We used to milk just under 60. So we're trying to cut everything back. But see, I only use a fraction of the milk that we make right now. Probably enough from one milking, and there's 14 milkings in a week. I use that to make my foods. Really small batch.
And they're sold in New York.
We're in about an hour south of Buffalo, and our altitude's around 1,800 feet. It's really hilly. It's very nice here. And so we graze all our cattle. It's something we always have. We rotationally graze them. They're out basically it's a full 6 months of the year, into seven. And they're out now, but they're just eating dry round bales outside in the sun and snow. You know what
but
I mean?
You sell your product in like Murray Cheese Shop?
You know, that was a fluke. Honestly, I got contacted. I worked on these foods for a long, long time. It took me about 7 or 8 years before I got a license and was able to build my certified plant and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I really had to figure it out. And while I was doing it, about 3 years into it, Murray's Cheese sent out an email to all the cooperative extension agents and the ag agents in every county in New York State. And they were looking for European-style fresh dairy foods.
Wow.
And my ag agent, who you know I work with a lot, who was really behind this project, said, you know, you ought to call these people up. So I did. And they asked me a few questions. I talked for a while. They said, you know, this is remarkable. Send us some food. And this is about 2003 or so, 2002. It was a long time ago. And I sent them a box of food, kind of like what I sent you, only it was, you know, really primitive. And I got an email the next day from this guy, and he was like, who are you, where are you, and where in the world did you learn how to do this? And that was the guy that owns Murray's Cheese, Rob Kofelt. And he said, I need to talk to you. And so we went down to visit him. And I didn't have a license, and I was years away from getting one. And he said, you know, your food was so delicious. He goes, how long is it going to take before you get a license so I can sell your stuff? And then they waited about 4 years until, but I was sending them things as I was coming up with foods and just making stuff. And finally, so that's the first place we sold it. Before we even got into a farmer's market here, which we sell most everything now.
But that's your big outlet, is local.
That is our outlet.
In
Buffalo, we go into Buffalo, it's about an hour from here, and there's a great farmer's market called the Elmwood Bidwell Farmer's Market, which is in the Olmsted Parkway, the park system in Buffalo, beautiful park system. And so we're set up in a really nice, in a grassy parkway under beautiful trees and, you know, right on one of the nice avenues. It's just great. And there's about 20 vendors, you know, various farmers and whatnot, and that market is great. But the problem with it is that it ends at Christmas.
Yeah.
And I go from May to Christmas because I make dairy foods year-round. A lot of vegetable guys, they stop because they're done. But we need to sell year-round in a farmer's market setting. So we started last year in a basement of a church in Buffalo, the Lafayette Presbyterian Church. We started a winter market, and we went into their loaves and fishes dining room and set up there on Sunday afternoons, and people would come in. And it was great because all our farmer's market customers was, you know, just a couple blocks from that other site. They all just started showing up on Sunday. And
but what happens to all of the rest of us who are in love with this product and can't get it? What happens? You don't do internet. You only do local, which is your concept anyhow. You'll never get to be producing on a commercial level. So are you involved with programs helping other communities develop this kind of a system?
Well, you know, that's a great idea. But what we're going to do is we're really going to expand on our own thought here in Buffalo. And that is we are... Right now, our local foods idea, Local Foods Buffalo, is we're going to build an indoor-outdoor year-round market, okay? We're looking to take an old school, Catholic school building, the gymnasium, and then there's the yard. And basically you have an outdoor market, an indoor market, and the indoor market will be a processing place. In other words, we're gonna process the dairy foods there. We're going to make them right there behind glass. We're going to have a bakery right there. We're basically going to build a place where all the various food makers and farmers can, there was going to be a place for stuffing sausage, you know what I mean?
Oh,
cutting
wow.
meat.
That's exciting.
And you'll come into this gymnasium and you'll look around and there'll be all this kind of stuff and then you can eat it too. The big problem with our farmer's market is all that food and nothing to eat, you know?
Well, Patrick, basically what you're telling us is that we've all got to pick up and move to Buffalo.
Well, you could do that, or, I mean, you're in Pittsburgh. Somebody can build that in Pittsburgh, you know, because it's, I mean, Buffalo is similar to Pittsburgh in a lot of ways. You know, it's like, I'm sure the Catholic churches in different parts of the city are closing there, too, or various churches. I mean, just as neighborhoods change, and that's what happened in Buffalo. But
do you have a resource center? Anybody interested in embarking on a project like this, who should they get in touch with?
Well, they can email me at orderfresh@aol.com, and you know I'll get back to them. At our local food site, we have to put an email button. We just have to build it now, because this is all coming together for us right now. I mean, we have the plans now, and to do this, and we just have to, we're in the earliest stages, but we hope to have it going in 2009. But I think the answer to your other question about the dairy foods is we're going to produce more there than I do in my kitchen here on the farm, because we'll have a setting where we can do that. We're going to expand. So yes, I think we might be able to send it around then. You know what I mean? We're certainly going to be making more quantities.
Well, I mean, one final note here is that your packaging is just delightful. It's the old-fashioned clear glass bottles, jars for yogurt, and bottles for the sports drink. And I have a new use for them, is that I have, for my spice racks, I have old drawers from old sewing machines mounted, like shelves.
Right.
And your yogurt jars fit in perfectly, so I'm transferring all of my spices into your jars and putting them on my shelf.
Oh, they're perfect. You know, lots of people do lots of things with them, and they are. They're, you know, glass happens to be the best container for acid-cultured dairy foods, you know. And so finding the right jar, I was really happy when I found that jar. I was perfect.
Well,
it's
Patrick,
a good portion, too.
Well, Patrick, you'll have to tell us when you get this new center in Buffalo off the ground.
Keep our email and email us.
Yeah,
I will.
Join us again and talk to us some more about that at that time. And in the meantime, we're just making the rhubarb yogurt last as long as we can.
Right. All right, that's terrific. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Patrick. Bye.
We were having so much fun with today's program. We ran a little bit over time, but I'm sure that you found it very interesting, and I hope that you'll join us again at On the Menu Radio, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.